You're listening to the LifeScan Learning Lab edition of the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie and co-host Todd LeDuc, episode 67.
Welcome to the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie. If you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or emergency medical professional who would like to improve your family relationships, your physical and mental health, and want to have success at work and at home, well, this show is for you. Welcome to the Get Balanced program. Let's get started.
Hey, folks, this is Dr. Donnie, and I am telling you, I'm excited that the Get Balanced podcast has an official sponsor, and I want to tell you a little bit about them. And it is FirstNet, built with the AT&T. And what I want to tell you about them is probably part of it is that many of you already know this, but for first responders and frontline workers, communication, as we know, is not a luxury, but it's a lifesaver. And that's why FirstNet, built with AT&T, was created. Now, the FirstNet mission is to make communication faster, safer, and more collaborative for first responders and other public safety personnel. FirstNet helps first responders and frontline workers connect when they are on and off duty. They get access to priority and preemption capabilities. This means they connect to the network first. In emergency situations, first responders move to the front of the line to access critical bandwidth they need to send and receive, whether it's voice, data, video, images, and text. Now, during an emergency, FirstNet is a critical connection between first responders to technology and also to each other, giving them access to information quickly and when every second counts. With FirstNet, first responders and frontline workers get a highly secure, reliable network with 24/7, 365 customer care and monitoring. Now, to get more information about FirstNet, go visit your local AT&T store or visit firstnet.com. Now, let me go in and introduce our guest for this week. You're listening to the Get Balanced podcast with Dr. Donnie, and this is the LifeScan Learning Lab edition with my co-host Todd LeDuc and our special guest Pete Gaynor. And let me kick this right over to you, Todd, and do a little bit more of a formal introduction with our guest, if you will.
Absolutely. Thanks, Donnie. Continues to be a pleasure working with you on taping these joint podcast. I've lost track. I think we're up to episode number 9 or 10 that we've taped. Dr. Lori Moore Merrill's interview is out yesterday, and I know that's getting rave reviews. And I'm especially pleased this week to have a tremendous guest with us, a friend of the fire service, Pete Gaynor, who was the immediate past FEMA director. I had the privilege of being introduced to him by Keith Bryant, Chief Keith Bryant, who's a longtime friend of mine and colleague. That was at Fire Rescue International a couple of years back, pre-COVID, where he was spending time actually with the fire service leadership. So, Pete, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Todd. Thanks, Donnie. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you. And I thought maybe we'd just start with, for our listening audience, if you could share a little bit about your background and your journey and through emergency management and where you are now, and just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Maybe I'll work my way backwards. Maybe make more sense. So today, I'm the director for resilience, response, and recovery for a company called Liro, L-I-R-O. They're mainly an engineering company, but they have a regional disaster recovery practice, and then I'm going to help them build that out across the country. They're part of a larger company called GISI, Global Infrastructure Solutions, Inc., and so about 14 companies all told. So we have great interest in disaster recovery, and I'm going to lend them a hand where I can to grow that business across the country. And prior to that, I was for a short term, I was the acting Secretary of Homeland Security towards the end of the previous administration. And then my real full-time job over the past couple of years was the FEMA administrator. I actually started out at FEMA as the deputy administrator. I worked for Brock Long. I'm sure everyone knows Brock. And then he decided to leave, and I fulfilled the acting role, and then became confirmed as the most recent former administrator. And then I had about a 4-year stint in state government. I was the director for Rhode Island Emergency Management for about 4 years. Worked for Governor Raimondo, who is now the Secretary of Commerce in the Biden administration. And then prior to that, I was a local emergency manager, and this is where I probably had the most fun, for 7 years in the city of Providence. Worked for a couple mayors, and really kind of honed all my skills about you know, what it really means to be an emergency manager, especially at the local level. So I've been at all three levels, local, state, and federal, and I have a certain perspective on all three of those now. And prior to that, I was in the Marine Corps for 26 years as an infantry officer. And then somehow I fell in, after I retired in 2007, fell into that first job at the city. And it's been nonstop ever since.
Now, that's a fantastic career. And thank you for your service. I know, you know, certainly, I know Donnie appreciates having served in the military. He's got a son who is 82nd Airborne and is now navigating to a fire school and a career in the fire service. And Excellent. He has a daughter heading into the service now as well. So
Thank you. I think the toughest job is being a parent of somebody in the service. So
it was when he was overseas, that's for sure, in Afghanistan.
It's hard to do.
So. It was. I was in the infantry as well.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Nice for your service.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, we certainly, particularly with Memorial Day just passing, owe a debt of service and gratitude to all the men and women in uniform that have served. So, and definitely a little place in my heart hearing that you're from the Northeast. I grew up in Boston and familiar with Providence, and Steve Perret is the public safety director. I know Steve well. And so
one of my former bosses.
Yes. Yeah. And, joke all the time when he's moving to Florida, it's so cold up there. So, I wanted to touch a little bit on, particularly since our listeners are public safety, you know, the role of the U.S. Fire Administration. You know, you mentioned that you've served in different levels of government, and, you know, sometimes from the fire service, U.S. Fire Administration can be this abstract entity. And sometimes we lose focus on the importance of U.S. fire and what it means and where it rests in under FEMA and DHS. So maybe if you could touch on the role of U.S. fire and the importance of that.
Yeah. And I'll just start, coming out of the military, I really had no background as an infantry guy. I had no really background in emergency management or local government or anything, right? It was not really in my wheelhouse. But when I got to the city, I think this is where I learned a lot. Learned a lot from a number of different firefighters, fire chiefs, police officers, police chiefs, mayors, and my fellow agency directors about, you know, what it takes to run a city. And especially if you're in the public safety service and the fire department, what is that really entail? And it is an amazing, you can have an amazing career and I think this is the magic in our system in the United States. It's all based on mutual aid. It's all based on local capacity. And so in the firefighting community, you know, we do mutual aid every day because that's just how we do business. We do it as a team. You know, firefighters do it as a team on trucks and ladders, and that's how they spend their life. So really oriented to the team effort that it takes to respond. And you know, from my point of view, the magic is, you know, if a disaster happens, you hear the cliche, you know, all disasters start and end locally. Well, I like to believe that all disasters should stay and end locally, right? So if it doesn't have to go to the state because that local has capacity, that's better for everyone. And if it doesn't have to come to the federal government, that's even better, right? Because we have that capacity. And so, you know, to answer the original question about, you know, the importance of NFA and everything that they do, is that they are tasked with building that capacity, you know, throughout America, right? So at the local level, and so whether it's a, you know, a one man or one woman firehouse up to, you know, a New York City firehouse, you know, they're tasked through grants and training, professional development to make sure that, you know, fire service, medical services can respond every day, because we need them to respond every day. And when it gets really, really bad and you need to upscale, that system exists. And so, you know, incident command and all those things that are second nature to us, right? I think, you know, the team up at Emmitsburg, they do a wonderful job spreading that that gospel and making sure that the country is ready for the next big disaster.
Yeah, that's a great point. And certainly having served as a fire chief at the county level, you know, there's a lot of, you know, just great reassurance knowing that if as an incident escalates, you know, especially down here in Florida, we're always, you know, always dealing with this time of year hurricanes and hurricane response but knowing that those resources are in place and pre-planned and available if needed and coordinated is tremendous for communities. But for sure, the goal is self-sustainment of local communities and escalation of incidents, you know, being able to support them. So you did touch on Emmitsburg, you know, I think, especially for our listeners, you know, at least from my experience, having attended the National Fire Academy, that really is a jewel of tremendous resource for public safety. Just the learning that goes on there, the networking, the best practice sharing. So, I wonder if you have any comments you'd like to add on that resource. I know with COVID, you know, they had to kind of shift gears a little bit, but I think they're getting back into the you know, the academic on campus learning.
Yeah, they are. And I think with everyone else, you know, we will get back to some level of normalcy. I'm not sure what that will actually look like, but we're getting closer to the end and hopefully back to some whatever the new normal is. You know, so you know, the U.S. Fire Administration is under FEMA, and we all know, you know, my former chief was Chief Bryant, who did a wonderful job, and really is responsible for everything that happens within the administration. And you are absolutely correct. The jewel at Emmitsburg is the National Fire Academy, and run now by, and I'm sure everyone knows all these names. You know, one of my favorite people is Dr. Dennis O'Neill, who retired last year. You know, mainstay of consistency up there and high level of academics and you know, high expectations. Now being managed by Chief Hoover, who's the acting administrator for the NFA. And then before I left, we hired Eric Gablitz as the superintendent, doing a bang up job up there. And from all reports that I hear, students have been eager to get back into the classroom because it's one of the only places that we built that you can train prospective chiefs and leaders in the fire service across the nation, come together in diverse groups, challenge each other with new ideas, and really hone, you know, the fire leadership for the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. So a really important place to be. It's also I think the only place, one or two of the places in the country where we have a live burn pit where you get certified to become a arson inspector, right? Not many people know that, but you need that certification to get that certification so you can actually go out and do arson investigations. So lots of great things happen up there. If you haven't been to Emmitsburg, you haven't been to the National Fire Academy, you really need to get up there and apply, even if it's for a short course. Even if you can't get into the leadership course, get up there because you'll be challenged in how you think about leadership and fire and all those things. But you'll make lifelong friends in the fire service from across the country, and that's probably the most important thing that happens up there.
Yeah, no, that is great. Great insights. Great point. You know, I know Eric's personally had the We had the wonderful opportunity, a group of us that have co-authored a book called Surviving the Fire Service. Eric's invited us all out to the Oregon Public Safety Training Academy, and really a global thinker in looking at not just fire, but public safety as a whole and how to integrate. So tremendous catch. And I know he's doing good up there. And for the audience that's listening and on the EM side of the house as well, I know we have the Emergency Management Institute located on those same grounds. So take the time. It's paid for by your tax dollars. It's a good way to professionally develop yourself and your staff. So tremendous opportunity. If you haven't availed yourself, please consider that. Pete, I want to touch on probably going to be my last point, and I know Donnie's probably going to have a couple questions, but I wanted to, from the fire service and particularly over the years, as the economy sometimes has expanded and shifted, and has what's been so important for the fire service, and whether we're talking about staffing, so actually boots on the ground, tip of the spear. I know our research community, what a phenomenal job they're doing with fire service research, whether that's occupational health or staffing levels or behavioral health. And then the whole assistance to firefighter grants as such a tremendous investment in the infrastructure of the fire service across the nation, whether it's volunteer departments or large urban departments. So I wonder if you could touch just a little bit on the grants directorate, those resources that are appropriated for the fire service and the importance of those, and any perspectives you may have on from that.
So just as background, FEMA manages about 98-99% of all the Homeland Security grants for the Secretary of Homeland Security. He kind of delegates down to FEMA, and we have a tremendous organization, grants organization, that manages billions of dollars of grant money, everything from UASI grants to EMPG grants, port security grants, and down to SAFER grants and AFG grants and the research grants and many more, right? So it's a full-time job. And one of the things when I was the administrator, one of the things that I love to do is go out around the country. You have to go to disasters, but I also like going out non-disaster and go visit our customers, right? And so I visited numerous fire chiefs, fire stations, from really big to really small, to some that are really well funded, have robust training programs, to some that are living on a shoestring, right? So it's the entire scale across the country, and for me, it's really important because, you can imagine at the administrator level, I'm approving with a pen stroke, $2.3 billion worth of grants. And sometimes that's all you see is that number. You don't see where it trickles down to across the nation, right? And so it's really important to get out there, visit with the chiefs, visit with the firefighters, and see what they need. And so the two big grants, especially the Assistance to Firefighter Grants, AFG, and the Staffing for Adequate Fire and Emergency Response, SAFER grant, are the two grants that are probably most important to the majority of fire chiefs and fire programs across the country. And never more important than this past 2020, right? We got some supplemental money to put some extra money out there for PPE, but it's critical to fire departments to have extra money to buy down gaps, to buy down risk for those things that maybe are not in their appropriated line items, or to try something that's innovative, right? That they have a good idea, they want to do something, because you can imagine a great idea, especially in the fire service, those things get, get like wildfire. Everyone wants to glom onto it and figure out, how can I be part of that new innovative approach? So it's really, really valuable that we have this money And the fire service competes with that, right? So it's a competitive program, and you really have to have, I think the when you talk about fire grants, this is the question I always ask the fire chief when I went down to visit and talking about grants, who's the grant writer, right? And the grant writer is always in the room because he is truly the most important guy or gal that's running that grant that is competitive to get approved and finally get that money down to where it's needed on the street. And again, when you think about local capacity, my belief is if you can build enough local capacity, then you build state capacity. If you can build enough state capacity, then you build federal capacity. So these are really important to not only the local, but to the nation, to make sure we make these investments. So that's kind of my 10,000 foot overview on the grants. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have on any of those.
No, and I want to certainly in my new role, after retiring as chief and then going to work for LifeScan Wellness Centers as their chief strategy officer and, seeing now 50,000 first responders a year for their annual occupational NFPA physicals. The AFG program for many departments is just a wonderful asset, not only for staffing and equipment, but to provide occupational health resources for their firefighters, physicals, behavioral health resources. So, we always talk about, the most important element, whether it's military or first responders, is taking care of our people. And for many departments, these funds are a lifeline.
Yeah. And I know there's been, I talked to Chief Bryant numerous times about, cardiac health for firefighters, cancer and behavioral health, all of these things really important. And it's really very simple. And some people may ask, maybe not, they're not invested in the fire service. Why are you worried about cardiac health and cancer health for firefighters? And the answer is simple. We invest a lot of money in these men and women to become firefighters and leaders. And without them, there is no accomplishment of the mission, right? So if you don't have firefighters that are able to accomplish the mission, then you have a big problem. So it's in everyone's best interest to include the firefighter, him or herself, to make sure that they take care of themselves and do all the things that we want them to do to have a really healthy, productive, and rewarding career, not cut short by a health problem or a behavioral health issue. So we want to invest as much money as we can in that to make some breakthroughs and make make the mission, healthier.
That's great. Great wisdom there. I had a mentor phrase it to me that if you don't have a healthy fire department, you don't really have a fire department. So
absolutely. Yeah.
So for, again, those that are listening, FEMA has a ton of this information on their website under the Grants Directorate. There's online pre-application education, tutorial tools, resources. So now's the time to start working with your team to make yourself having the best opportunity to fund those critical programs for your troops. So Pete, it's been a pleasure just spending some time with you today. I'm glad you're doing well. I know you're going to be a success in your new role. I look forward to watching you develop that infrastructure as you continue to roll that out. And I'm going to turn this over now to Donnie and let him walk through the remainder of today's podcast. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great.
All right. Well, thanks, Todd. And Pete, I tell you, I want to jump on this piece about the health and wellness that you were just talking about. And, but before I do, we've never met. So I do want to give you a little bit of background where I'm coming from when it comes from work-life balance is that my research that was published just a couple of years ago, essentially focused on people or basically leaders that take really good care of themselves, their physical health, their mental health, social health and spiritual health, basically their self-care. What did that do for them when we think about this thing called work-life balance, right? And what it was is that it appeared that it was foundational, such as you got to take care of your health and wellness if you want to be effective either at work or at home. And then the concept became is it truly a myth or not? Can you be successful at work and home, or is that a myth? And it's like, you know, I think we do know that we can be successful in all areas of our life, but we got to take care of ourselves too. And as public servants, you know, that they push, sometimes they fail to look, take care of the person in the mirror a little bit, you know. But when you were talking about, I want to share with you something, because it got me thinking. He talked about the local capacity that you want to, you know, you focus on building up the local capacity, because when you have local capacity, that gives the state a capacity, state that builds the state capacity. And if all states build the capacity, that builds the federal capacity. At least that's the way I was hearing it. Think of it. I see such of an analogy there. Local capacity equates to the firefighter, if they, and their self-care, how well they take care of themselves, their physical health, mental health, that self-care. If they all build up that self-care and their health and wellness, then that built, you know, that then builds up, I think it also builds up the family capacity, because then they are there for them, their families, they're supportive. And then when you have my belief, you have a great foundation at home and your health and wellness, that builds up the firehouse.
Yeah.
What do you think of that analogy?
No, I think you're absolutely correct. And you know, this is these public safety jobs and at any level, right? I mean, they're high jobs, the public expects a lot out of you, and the public is unforgiving, right? And so, you know, I'm speaking from my own experience. You know, that's always in the back of your mind about, you know, making sure that you're able to accomplish the mission. So you can probably tell I'm mission oriented. Able to accomplish the mission. But again, you need the people to do that. And you have to, as a leader, make sure that they understand that you're going to take care of them. But you actually owe them something, right? You need to actually take care of yourself, because you can't just say it and not do it.
Right.
And so when you say, I won't use any names, but if they're listening, they know who I'm talking about. So I had some really key people at FEMA during the past year. I mean, key people. And I'm going to say no one's indispensable, but there are some people that, man, if they left, there'd be trouble, right? It would take a while to get back up to that high functioning capacity. And everyone's stressed out. Everyone is going 100 miles an hour, and for all the obvious reasons, because you have to. And then I tell this young man that you need to go home. Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, there's no way I can go home. I said, buddy, you have to go home, and I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear you on a conference call. I don't want to like see that, you know, your initials are hiding somewhere and you know how it all on a virtual world, because there'd be trouble. And, so reluctantly he went home and, you know, spent 3 or 4 days with his family, with his kids, got recharged, got some food, got some sleep, try not to think about what was going on the best he could, and comes back a better man, right? And again, this is across the board. And then one day, I had some great staff around me. So one day, one of my staff says, hey, listen, you speak a good game, but you have to go home now too, right? And sometimes, you know, you think, well, I'm the guy, right? I can't go home. But you actually can, and you actually need to, because and I've seen it among leaders at the senior level. If they don't take care of themselves, everyone suffers for it, and it's not a good thing. So you really have to just not say it; you have to do it, and it is as critical to accomplishing the mission and becoming high functioning and taking care of your family as being there. Right? You have to kind of get that. You know, readjust that paradigm that's in your head that most people say, if I leave, it's all going to fall apart. Well, if that's the case, then you didn't do your job right, because you didn't train your number two to take over, right?
Right.
And if you train your number two right, he or she can fit right in and not miss a beat. So go home and get some rest. But it's a hard thing to do, especially in high stakes kind of situations. So no matter if you're a chief of a 20-man department, or a chief of the biggest department in the country, you have to do that for your troops, and you have to do it for yourself, and you have to do it for your family.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And how you said it supports the mission. Let me ask you on this.
Yeah.
Instead of it supporting the mission, could you see it becoming part of the mission.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think we need to, you know.
I don't think it's there yet.
No, and no, I mean, it takes some effort. But if you make it part of the, you know, part of the culture, right?
Yeah.
And I'll just give you my Marine Corps, and you know, as a soldier, you probably know the same thing. If you didn't exercise during the day, right, on your own, people looked at you like, hey, that guy's not doing enough, or that gal's not doing enough. So, yeah. And I don't know what it was in where you serve, but you know, for lunchtime in the Marine Corps, especially as an officer or a staff NCO, you're going out to PT during lunch. You're not eating. You're going out to take care of yourself, right? And to, you know, be the best you can be. And that's just part of the culture, right? Not doing it, people frown upon you for doing it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, why can't we build that into public safety where part of your day is, and so I'm using the example of physical exercise, but it could be something else, right? To take care of yourself. Why not have that become part of your duty day, right? That you're going to go do this, we're going to pay you for it, and you're going to come back healthier, right? And more effective. You know, but again, that's a cultural challenge that we're going to have to set the example on. But I think it's what we need to do.
Yeah. Comes back to leadership, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now in the NFA and, you know, with the academy and things like that and the leadership classes that are taught, do you think, is this currently being taught now, or do you see this something getting into the curriculums? What I like to call it sort of like leading the whole person. You know, it's just not teaching them how to become a better firefighter, but leading them to take better care of themselves. Make sure you're taking care of your family, that you don't want, who wants a firefighter to go through a divorce?
Nobody.
No one wants that, you know. So, right. But are we? Do you think we're going to trend to where we're going to start leading that whole person with their health and wellness and their?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's, again, you know, I'm not an expert in you know, all of this, but I know in talking to my peers like Chief Bryant that it is part of discussion. You know, is it enough of the curriculum today? Probably not, right? I mean. So, you know, if I'm a student that wants to go to fire academy, you know, I'm probably going because I want to like be a better leader and learn how to like do the operational part of firefighting better, right? That's probably why I'm going. You know, am I signing up to become a better, well-rounded person? Probably not, but why we should try to like, you know, try to achieve that, hey, we're going to teach you to be a better firefighter, and we're going to teach you to be a better leader and a more well-rounded, you know, individual. Right. And I think, you know, like anything else, it takes pressure. It takes someone to like stand out there and say that it's important and actually like mandate that it happen. And so, you know, I would, you know, those that are listening up there, call Chief Hoover, call Gablets, call the team up there and, you know, see what they're doing, ask them if they're doing it. And if they're not doing it, then why aren't they doing it? And maybe a pilot program. Right. So all these things kind of start like that. So if the demand's out there, then the NFA, they will rise to the occasion.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure they are. Right. I mean, I've been going a few months. And so, you know, what has transpired since I've gone, I can't speak to that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll give you Tanya's cell phone.
There you go. And, well, and then, as Todd, you know, with it being life, as he heads up the strategy with LifeScan Wellness Centers, that, you know, I hear such success stories on some of these podcasts with him that it is just great work that they're doing over there with these very, very thorough, physicals, if right, preventive checkups and all of that. What I hear, I mean, I'm not an expert on that side of it at all, but what I hear is that trend, it's starting to be a popular trend to let, you know, we are smarter about all the toxins in the fire today than what we ever have been. And that it's like, we need to get this because the cancer is it's a real deal.
Right? Yeah. And you know, and I just triggered a couple of things in my mind. You know, going out to visit fire stations, one of the things that come to mind that chiefs were so proud of, like in getting a grant, like AFG grant, was taking me to the the laundry room, where they have, you know, the specialized machines to clean all the bunker gear, mm-hmm. and, you know, two sets of gear, so you can always have a fresh set, and really like an effort to, you know, to make sure that, you know, people stay healthy. But, you know, when you think about the fire service, you know, we're always inspecting the big red trucks to make sure they all work, they all squirt water, and all the ladders work, right? They go in for a maintenance check. We're always checking our gear. We're checking our, all our SPCAs. We're always constantly checking equipment. Does the chainsaw run? Is it oil? All those things, we always do it.
Yeah.
But are we checking the dipstick on the firefighter enough? Like the same kind of thing to make sure that because it is part of, you know, it's part of the system.
Yeah.
So it should have the same kind of focus and effort that we put towards the tangible firefighting pieces of equipment. Why not put it to the human piece of the firefighting equipment?
Absolutely. That preventive maintenance. Put it right on.
Yep.
Absolutely. Nah, it'd be great for everyone. That's for sure. And I'll tell you, I don't have anything else. Is there anything that you wish Todd or I would have asked you that we did not? Or something you'd like to spend more time on?
Well, I mean, I think the only thing that we have seen and will continue to see is wildfires. And you know, last year was a historic year in every way, from California to Colorado to Washington State. You know, I hope it's not the same way this year, but you know, the trend is, you know, the past couple of decades, wildfires have been, you know, every year exceeds the year previous, right? You know, people live closer to, you know, the forests. And so, you know, the WUI, the wildland urban interface has become an important part of you know, how we prevent fires from escalating, how we mitigate fires that are already, you know, has already started. And to keep, you know, the our citizens safe. And I know there's a lot of effort has been put into that over the past couple of years. I know, Chief Bryant and DHS, S&T released wildfire operational requirements and capability analysis, kind of like best case or best practices in the urban interface. Mm-hmm. And I think we really need to focus on that because it's not going to get any better, right? Until we actually do something about it. This past, I think in 2018, you know, Congress passed the DRRA, the Disaster Recovery Relief Act, Recovery Reform Act, DRRA. And in it, they did a lot of things. One of the things they allowed for mitigation money for FMAG, so that the firefighters get a grant for a fire that breaks out. And inside of that is mitigation money to go towards some of these things to prevent the next fire, right? To be more proactive. And I just think as a nation, especially if you're in a fire prone part of the nation, you really have to take it upon yourself as a citizen to build with best practice in mind. So, you know, don't build with, roofs that can catch on fire, clear defensible space around your property, join with other neighbors to not just do your house, but do your entire neighborhood. And I've been on the site of some fires and I've been on every kind of disaster as administrator. And there's nothing in my mind, nothing worse than the aftermath of a fire, a wildland fire, because, you know, in a hurricane or a flood, you know, for the most part, you know, your structure is probably still standing. It's a little beat up. Your belongings are inside, maybe a little wet, a little soggy. But when it comes to a firefighter, wildland fire, there is nothing left. And I say that, I mean that. There's virtually nothing left. I mean, maybe the thing that I see, if you look at a landscape of fires in California in particular, across a neighborhood that had, you know, 50 houses, the only thing you see left are cars that are almost burned to nothing, and gas grills, right? Because they're made not to burn. And that's all there is. So your entire life, right? Everything that you own is in ashes at the bottom of your foundation, right? It is really the worst disaster I think someone could undergo. So, I mean, I think as a nation, as a community, as firefighters, fire chiefs leading the way, really need to focus on the wildland urban interface to make sure that it doesn't get any worse.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I'll tell you what, I want to give a shout out to Marin County in Northern California. They contacted me last week and asked, hey, we'd like to bring your work-life balance workshop to the men and women that are going to be fighting the California wildfires, because they join in with CAL FIRE. Yeah. And they said, we don't have a date yet, but it'd be November and or early December, right after fire season, because we know it's going to be a very long season and we want them to start thinking, reprioritizing their priorities at that point, start thinking about their family and taking care of themselves.
Yeah.
And I was talk about work.
Yeah. Talk about work-life balance, right?
Oh,
not only are you, I mean, you're fighting a fire that never ends, right? So that the day never seems to end.
And the long shifts, you know, the
yeah. And you're at risk of losing your home yourself. Yeah. I have met firefighters that have lost their homes. So imagine that. So not only you lose your home, your family doesn't have a place to go. I mean, just, you know,
it's terrible.
So yeah, we really need to double down on
firefighting. Now, I did hear something on the, I was listening to the radio. I was driving through, I was in Arizona earlier this week, and I thought I heard a report. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard a report about the drought is like 50% greater than it was last year at this time. That they're talking about the reservoirs are lower. Yeah. And I thought they didn't mention anything about fire, but just, you know, I'm just stretching it to where, like, well, that doesn't sound like a good setup for fire season at all.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a, you know, we built this, in some cases, we built this fragile world, and in some cases we're living with the results of that. Right.
Yeah.
So again, lots to do out there. You know, investments in infrastructure, investments in pre-disaster mitigation, you know, all those things that matter. You know, I've seen that the current administration, is going to add another $500 million to the BRIC program, Building Resilient Infrastructure in Communities, which is the new grant that we started last year to get to some of these things, right? Focus on infrastructure, make it more resilient, and avoid the disaster that you know is going to happen, right?
Yeah.
Because this country, you know, and you can look at this past year with COVID and historic hurricane season and historic wildfire season, that we will pay any price in the aftermath of that, but let's invest some of that money up front before the disaster happens to avoid it. Right.
Yeah.
It's the smart thing to do. And it saves billions of dollars in the long run. Right. It's a smart investment.
Yeah. We have a lot of those, don't we? We know it's good for the infrastructure. We know it's good for the human being. The more preventive health measures we take, the less expensive it is on the back end. Yeah.
So. Yep. Just need some leadership and change that culture a little bit, and we'll be on our way. It's happening.
Yeah.
And again, you got to keep the pedal to the metal on it.
No, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Pete, for being our guest.
Thanks, Donnie.
On the LifeScan Wellness or Learning Lab edition, I should say, of the Get Balanced podcast. Have a great day.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Hey, if you're a firefighter, law enforcement officer, or EMS professional who enjoys this podcast and would like some help with your work-life balance, you need to check out my Get Balanced program. Not sure if you are balanced or not? Join me over at DonnieHutchinson.com and take the quiz. Together, we are going to get you balanced.